So this is the last lecture. I'll finish the subject I'd started last time I spoke to you. That was Wednesday. And then I'll talk about a different subject. So I was building up to giving you some postulates for quantum theory, but I never got around to writing the postulates down. So let me do that, and then we can talk about them a bit. So and these are from 2001, my 2001 paper. So the first postulate, I call it the information postulate. And well, I'll write it down. So systems having or constrained to have a given information carrying capacity n. So n is the amount of information the system can carry, or you might say log of n is the amount of information the system can carry if you want to measure it in bits, have the same properties. So let me just give an example. So an example in quantum theory, if you have two systems and they both have a two-dimensional Hilbert space, then actually they have the same state space. There's a sort of mapping between the state spaces. They have the same space of transformations. They have the same space of measurements. Or another example might be if you had a five-dimensional Hilbert space in quantum theory, but you constrained yourself to states that existed only in some two-dimensional subspace of that five-dimensional double space. So you were constraining to have a given information carrying capacity. Those constrained states and so on would have the same properties as a system having just n equal to 2. You can say this in... No, then I was just giving you some examples. So now let me state this in slightly more operational language so I'm not referring to quantum theory. So imagine you have a preparation of some states. We have boxes that compare various states. And you consider all the, so preparing states, you're going to represent them by a list of probabilities. And now you consider a measurement over here which is such that it can distinguish some set of m greater than n states. And m is the maximum number of distinguishable states for this kind of preparation, for this kind of system. So we have a system type. We look at all the possible preparations. We find subsets of preparations that can be distinguished by the outcomes of some measurement, and then we find the set of preparations like that, which is the biggest set of preparations that can be distinguished, which is the biggest. Okay, and then with that measurement in place, we can now restrict ourselves. We can just consider, say, some subset of these outcomes, say a subset of n outcomes, and now consider preparations which only give rise one of these n outcomes and never give rise to the outcomes which are not in this set. Okay. And that's an operational way of restricting ourselves to consider systems which are constrained to have some given information carrying capacity. And when we say they have the same properties, we mean that when they're so restricted, the set of states is the same, the set of these are the R vectors, these are the same, and the set of transformations are the same. So all the set of states, set of transformations, all these things are the same for systems having the same N, or restricted to have the same N.
Are you saying that, like, let's say two systems are totally different systems,
yeah,
made out of totally different stuff?
Yeah.
And if it has, like, have a same condition that it has same M output, but we, like, for some reason, comparison just give a N different outcomes.
Yeah, restricted.
Restricted to give an N different outcome, but because the system is made out of totally different stuff, like those N outcome might be very different thing.
Yeah.
But do we, can we still say that two systems have the same properties?
Like, well, that's the axiom. That's the assumption. That's the postulate, and it is true. It is true in quantum theory.
So.
And it's also true in classical probability theory. So an example in classical probability theory would be if you you consider if you have 27 boxes with a ball that can be in one of those boxes, but you restrict it so that the ball can actually only be can only give results that it's in one of some three given boxes, or you have a die which has six possibilities, but you restrict it so that it can only give rise to one, three, or six. So in both of those cases, because we've restricted n to be equal to three, should I say three in the case of the ball?
Yeah.
Then actually the state space looks like this, whatever it is. Let me just call them one, two, three. The state space is a simplex like that in the classical case.
So the properties here is statistical, statistics are particular outcomes.
So it's to do, yeah. So the properties we're talking about here are probabilistic properties, yes. Yeah. And maybe it's even worth the same. Yeah. It's maybe even worth putting that word in here. Of course, the color of the boxes may be different. The dimensions of the objects, but the probabilistic properties are the same, and I call this property information. If you think about information, you may want to store information on a hard drive or on a floppy disk if you're back in the 1980s, or a memory card or whatever. But the sort of properties are the same. You don't really care what substance you use to store the information in. It has the same properties. And this is that statement for sort of probabilistic theories. The second assumption is information locality, and I told you about that on Wednesday. It's just the statement that you multiply n's, or if you take logs, you add. And then we have tomographic locality. I discussed these two things already quite a lot.
I'm still confused, like, why, like, two and three conditions, how to two holographic locality and information locality are different? I mean, I know by definition, but by identification,
I mean, they're very different axes because N is a very different quantity from K. N refers, operationally, to understand what N is, you need to consider, you know, sets of states that can be distinguished in a single shot measurement. Whereas to understand what K is, you're looking at the number of probabilities you need to specify your state. So they are different and they play different roles. I mean, they're similar, multiply together numbers, but the different numbers you multiply together. Okay. So two more postulates. There exists a continuous reversible transformation between any pair of pure states. For some given system, for any given system. So I'm not sure if I was explicit about the definition of what a pure state is in the operational framework. But remember that in this framework, you can always, if you have two states, you can always form a new state by taking the convex combination. And pure states are states which cannot be written as a convex combination of other states. This is where. Pure states are states that cannot be written like this, where lambda is not equal to 1 or 0, and these two states are distinct. Geometrically, pure states are extremal states. Well, it's the same thing, but pure states are states at the states which are sort of, you get pure states if you have some part of the boundary where you can't find, there's no way to continue a line through this point where both segments of the line are inside the set. So this state here is mixed, it's not pure, because you can continue a line through it. And both segments of the line on either side of the state are inside the set. Whereas this point here, you can't do that. And the word continuous is playing an important role here. I'll come back to that. And then the last postulate is the one that I didn't like, and other people didn't. Simplicity. that systems are described by the smallest number of probabilities that are consistent with the other postulates. So for each n, k should be as small as possible. This fifth axiom does is, remember I showed you that k is equal to n to the power r. What it does is it fixes r. You take the smallest r consistent with the other postulates. So, the smallest value of r we can consider is r equals 1. But that fails because of this continuity axiom. See, if you have a classical system, for example, this one, well, then you have only a finite set of pure states here at the vertices. These are the pure states. These states here along here are not pure states because you can take complex combinations of these pure states to get to these points. And whilst there is a reversible transformation that takes this state to this one, you can just permute these. There's no continuous reversible transformation. It's not possible to go continuously from here to here, because then you would have to be, at every point in that transformation, you'd have to be in a new pure state, and there's only a finite set of pure states. Whereas if you take the set of quantum states for a block ball, for example, if you're at one point on the surface, take this point, and you want to go here, then you can do that continuously through the pure states. So there exists a transformation which is reversible. In quantum theory, these are the unitary transformations. And at each point, and it's continuous, and so it takes you through the pure states. Okay. So this is a distinction between the two cases. So in this set of axioms, this is the word, the key word that gives you quantum theory. If you cross that word out, then, and you still impose simplicity, then you get instead classical probability theory, because then you have k equals n.
Why is it not possible in classical theory to move along the
slanted line? So you can show that if you have a state and you hit it with a transformation which is reversible, then the new state that you get is also pure. Okay, you want this to be continuously reversible. So what that means is that you can make it out of lots of little reversible transformations. So even just consider two. So imagine I want to be able to get from here to here with two transformations. So at this point, this has to be pure, but there's no pure state between here and here. So that's why it can't be done. I didn't define what a reversible transformation is. So this is a transformation. If I have a preparation described by, and the state is, whatever the state is, and then I have a transformation, T, transformation is reversible if there exists another transformation, we call it T to the minus 1, such that the state coming out is the original state that went in, but all possible states going in. Mathematically, that ends up corresponding to the property that Z to the minus 1 is, first of all, that the matrix Z is non-singular, and that also Z to the minus 1 is in the set of allowed transformations. So with this set of postulates, you get quantum theory for finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. you get the tensor product structure. You get some water. You get the fact that the states are described by positive density, by positive operators that are normalized to have a trace less than or equal to one. You get completely positive maps. You get POVMs. So you get the sort of structure, the basic structure of quantum theory as it's used, for example, in quantum information theory. You don't get any particular Hamiltonian. These postulates have nothing to say about H bar, so you're not getting any particular dynamics. You're just getting sort of the basic structure of finite dimensional quantum theory.
How do we get the Schrödinger equation?
So what you get is that the dynamics is described by completely positive maps. A special case of completely positive maps is unitary transformations. So you get that those are allowed also. And unitary transformations are, and the Schrodinger equation gives you unitary transformations.
So,
but you don't get a particular Hamiltonian in this approach. This is operational quantum theory I'm deriving, and so it's the sort of transformations associated with boxes, which are integrated, if you like, the integrated Schrodinger equation. You integrate over some evolution given by the Schrodinger equation, so you're just getting some unitary evolution associated with a finite time interval.
But to get those particular unitary, like to determine which unitary transformation is responsible for the evolution of the state, like we need the equation of motion, like Schrödinger equation.
So you need a particular Hamiltonian.
I mean, like Schrödinger equation is like, even we don't know what the Hamiltonian is, like we can write down the Schrödinger equation, right? But like in case of Emerson's postulate, like he included the Schrödinger equation as a power of the postulate to transform the state. But here, like, there is no signature of Schrödinger equation at all, so.
Well, you get the unitary operators, and those are given by the Schrödinger equation. I mean, in quantum information, again, let me put it differently. You can show that you can realize any completely positive map within quantum theory. So in some sense, it's a more general statement of what quantum theory is about. So if you have the Schrodinger equation, you can use that to realize unitaries. And this is what we get unitaries. So unitaries act on states, and that's what they give you. So it's kind of got Schrodinger's equation built in because you get unitaries. But it doesn't give you a particular Hamiltonian for that. But it's more general because you also get completely positive maps, which can't be given by the Schrodinger equation unless you trace over some other system.
Is the tensor product structure come from the homographic locality?
Yes. Yeah.
And is it independent of the second assumption?
It is independent. There are some more recent axiomatizations that get rid of the information locality postulate. They derive it from the other postulates, but they still need the tomographic locality postulate. And actually, I think even in this set of postulates, I think you could cross out number two and derive information locality from tomographic locality and continuity using techniques that Marcus Muller invented. So they're logically distinct. Any more questions?
Is the condition four guarantee the probability? This postulate does not necessarily guarantee that the whole probability is conserved.
No.
It is just a continuous and reversible, is it?
Right, yeah. So in the background here, we're just taking probabilities to be basically things that are described by the Kolmogorov of axioms. So any set of postulates like this, you can always ask yourself the question of what's being assumed in the background. And that's one of the things we're assuming in the background. The properties are things that satisfy the Kolmogorov axioms. And you can find other assumptions in the background as well. We're assuming this kind of structure of circuits and so on. So subsequent work that I've done and other people have done have made these kinds of background assumptions more explicit. But it would take me longer to go through them. So there has been a tremendous amount of work in the last 10 years. So Marcus Moller and Louis Massanas have a paper. People in Vienna, Chesla Bruckner and co-authors, have worked on this. There's people from Pavia, Giulio Chiarabella, Amara Dariano, and Paolo Perinotti have an axiomatization of quantum theory. And they're all sort of in this kind of general framework, and there's a lot being done since. And all the ones I just mentioned get rid of the simplicity axiom. So show that you don't need to assume, you just take the smallest one, you can actually prove that you get k equals n squared. So I think that these postulates and the other postulates are, they're nice, but they're not, I don't think they're as compelling as, as Einstein's postulates for special relativity or Newton's laws. They're not quite there yet, and I think that the subject is still open. I feel like there's really a big step forward could be made and to really make these axioms compelling or to just recast this whole business in a more compelling way. So I'm hoping that will happen at some point and someone will come up with something that's really compelling in the same way that has been done with, with Newton and Einstein, but I don't see how to do it myself. Okay. So I'm going to finish with I think it's an interesting topic, and this is the question about what's the shape of quantum space? Of quantum state space. We can try and get some insight into this from some fairly simple considerations. So first of all, we know that k is equal to n squared for quantum theory. So the normalized states have just where you take out one dimension, n squared minus one. And then the states on the boundary of the normalized states are where you take out another dimension. But we can ask what's the dimension of the pure states Does anyone know the answer to that question? How many real parameters do you need to describe pure states for a Hilbert space of dimension n? Sorry? No, that's the, I'm interested in just the number of real parameters you need to specify a particular pure state, given that you know you have a pure state. So the answer is, well, you can write down pure states like this in some basis. So you need 2n complex numbers. Sorry, you need n complex numbers, which is 2n real numbers, except that we have two constraints. There's an arbitrary overall phase, so we can take out one number for arbitrary overall phase. And then we impose normalization. So that's, we take out another number, so we need 2n minus 2. So yeah, it's interesting to look at these three expressions. So we get most of our intuition, a lot of our intuition, we get it from looking at the qubit case, the n equal to 2 case. And then you can see, well, if n is equal to 2, then the boundary, then k minus 2, which is the dimension of the boundary, is equal to has two dimensions in it, and that's the same as the dimension of the pure states, and that's just the surface of the block ball, block sphere. However, if you have n greater than 2, like n equal to 3, for example, then k is n squared, so that's 9 minus 2 is 7. And the dimension, so that's the dimension of the boundary. But the dimension of the pure states is smaller. It's 6 minus 2 is 4. So the picture we have when you go away, when you go to a Q-trit or higher, is that not all the states on the boundary are pure. But we have another fact as well, which is that the pure states kind of form a sort of continuous and closed set. You know, in the immediate vicinity of any pure state, there's lots of other pure states. So there's no edge in the space of pure states. So it's not, one example of a convex set let's not say that. But you can sort of visualize, you know, convex sets where not all the states on the surface are pure. So these are pure states, but these ones are not. But this has an edge. So can we visualize what's happening here? Now, the problem is that my imagination doesn't extend to 7 dimensions or 8 dimensions. But here's an example in just three dimensions. So last year, one of the Psi students named this the Pringle example. So this is the Pringle space. This is Ben Burdick. So imagine that you have a ring. Okay, so made out of wire, for example. And now you just gently bend the ring. So now the perimeter of the ring is sort of like the perimeter, or the ring is sort of like the perimeter of a Pringle. Okay. So I have to try and draw that. So that's my best attempt to draw the a Pringle. And now what you can do is treat this as your set of extremal states, as your set of pure states, and complete it. So join every pure state to every other pure state so that you get what's called the convex hull. So I'm joining all these pure states. So you kind of get, now you get a three-dimensional object, which I'm trying to draw. Okay, so if you imagine that shape where you just, you sort of fill in all the gaps. So I've completed this into a three-dimensional object by joining every pure state to every other pure state. And now you have an example of an object which has a set of extremal states, which is one-dimensional, whereas the boundary is two-dimensional. So this is an example of an object that's sort of like this. Of course, it isn't a seven-dimensional example. It also has a continuous set of pure states with no edges. So that's my best attempt to represent what quantum space looks like in this higher dimensions.
So you're saying the wire is the pure state?
Yeah.
And what is the line connecting?
That was just my attempt to sketch, filling it out. So you fill out all the. So between every pure state, you should include all the states in between. That's called taking the convex hull. So you take a set of extremal states, and then you find every state that you can get by mixing together the pure states, and that gives you the entire convex space. So that's my attempt to draw that.
But in this particular case, the surface is still just the wire.
No, the surface is not, because there'll be some states at the top. Okay, if I join this pure state to this, here's a state that's on the surface, but it's not one of the pure states. And so the surface, because this thing lives in three dimensions, once I bend the wire, it's now living in three dimensions. And the surface of a three-dimensional object has to be two-dimensional, but the wire is only one-dimensional. Okay. How much time do I have? So one question you can ask is, if you're in a state which is on the boundary but it's not pure, what does that look like, or why are there such states? And so in quantum theory, you can.
If the wire is bent, Do I have void here, or is
no,
it also filled?
No, everything is filled everywhere. Everywhere is filled. So this is a solid object. Every point inside here is also an allowed state, but they're all mixed. Yeah. So it's hard to draw. Okay. So just to understand how the states in the boundary look, I can write down any density matrix as a sum over its eigenvalues, and then let me partition that out like this. So I've got eigenvalues 1 through to n, and then I've written the state down as a convex combination of the one part and then all the other parts. These numbers are positive numbers in here. So a density matrix can always be written like this. But if you look at this one, this state is mixed for all values of lambda. If lambda is 0, then you still have, assuming these things are more than one of these is non-zero, you still have a mixed state over here. And yet, you can also see that that when lambda equals 0, you're at a boundary, because it's impossible for lambda to go negative. If lambda was to be negative, then this would no longer be a positive operator. It would have some negative eigenvalues. So lambda has to be greater than or equal to 0. And where lambda equals 0, therefore, you must be in the boundary. But these states, when lambda is equal to 0, are mixed. So you can see why states in the boundary are unmixed. Because if you continue the parameter lambda, if you've got some space and you parameterized these states with the parameter lambda, as you go along here, this is where it's 0 and this is where it's negative. Then you hit an edge, and on the other side of that, you're in the space where states aren't allowed. Okay. Okay. So this gives you some intuitive feel for the nature of the space of states. You can also get an algebraic handle on this. You can write down equations. So. So you can write down this condition. You can say that the state is pure if rho is equal to rho squared. So the only Hermitian operators that satisfy this are ones that are projectors. If you think about what this equation gives you, you can translate rho into a list of probabilities. As I've told you before. So if you calculate what this is equal to in terms of p's, you're going to get that each of these p's is a quadratic function. of the list of probabilities. So you get n squared equations, n squared quadratic equations. So what's interesting is that you can actually specify, so these n squared quadratic equations give you the pure states. But you can actually get the pure states with just two equations instead of n squared. One of them is quadratic and one of them is cubic. So there's papers by Chris Fuchs and collaborators where this is discussed. And the theorem itself comes from a paper by Jones and Linden in 2004. So I'm going to give you, here's the condition. Trace of rho squared equals trace of rho cubed equals 1. So you have two equations, trace of rho squared equals 1 and trace of rho cubed equals 1. So if these two conditions are satisfied and rho is a Hermitian matrix, so for rho then rho is a rank one projector. In other words, it's a pure state. Rank one projector, yeah.
So here we assume the equation and also the rho is Hermitian. It says rho is a pure state.
Yeah. So assuming that rho is Hermitian is a very simple condition to verify. You just look at the matrix entries. So that's not a problem. We're not assuming that it's a positive operator, incidentally, just that it's a Hermitian. Positivity follows from these equations.
It's just, like you said, it is rank one, but pure state is not necessarily the rank one.
Yeah, pure states are rank one projectors. Yeah. Put it another way. Pure states are the ones that have one eigenvalue equal to 1 and all the other ones equal to 0. Just terminology. So what's remarkable is it seems that this wasn't, no one knew about this until 2004. It's a very simple result. It's sort of an important result because it helps characterize the pure states. Chris Fuchs asked lots of experts who ought to have known this, and nobody seemed to know about this condition. Jones and Linden only used it as a kind of side result. The paper they wrote was not about this, it was about something else, and this is just a way of proving it. So Chris Fuchs has been promoting this, I think he calls it the remarkable equation, the remarkable result. And also in this paper, this one is by Fuchs and Schack, the first paper, they give a very simple proof. So I'll just sketch the simple proof. So if you write down, if you write down the eigenvalues of rho, let them be lambda I, then this condition tells you that the sum of the squares of the eigenvalues is 1, because if you multiply rho in diagonal form by itself, you're just multiplying together the diagonal elements. You're taking the square of the diagonal elements, and then you take the trace, so you sum. This condition tells you That's true. The first condition implies that because lambdas, these are eigenvalues, so they're real numbers. Like eigenvalues of Hermitian operators, they're real numbers. So so the squares have to be positive, which means that none of these individual squares can be greater than one. So the magnitude of lambdas has to be less than or equal to one. Which is the same thing as saying that. If you take take equation one, subtract equation two. Actually, I think I want it the way around. Take equation, no, that's right. Then you get this equation. And you can see that, these have to be greater than or equal to zero. And we just established that these have to be greater than or equal to zero. And yet the sum has to be zero. So we know that for each I, either lambda is equal to one or lambda is equal to zero. But furthermore, from this equation, we know that one of them has to be, given that, one of them has to be one and all the rest have to be zero. That's from. So that means that the state is rank one projective. It's a pure state. Okay. And if you think about these two equations, the first equation, trace of rho squared equals one, is saying that some quadratic function, of the pk's is equal to one. And the second one is saying that some cubic of these probabilities is equal to one. So you have a quadratic and a cubic equation in the that constrain you to the pure states in the state space. And it's interesting to look at this in the context of, so for quantum theory, you can get the pure states by imposing a quadratic and a cubic equation. Let's look at the classical case. So here we have some probabilities. They're all supposed to be between 0 and 1. And we know that the sum of them if we're talking about normalized states, the sum of them is equal to 1. So this is an equation, but this is inequality. These are inequalities. But we can cross this out and write down this instead. So this equation defines a sphere whose origin is at the center and whose radius is 1. So it just cuts through these points. This equation defines a flat surface, and this triangle is part of that flat surface. So these two equations together pick out exactly the pure states. So So in the classical case, you need two equations to get the pure states, one linear and one quadratic. In the quantum case, you need two equations to get the states, one quadratic and one cubic. It almost suggests that there's some interesting hierarchy. So I don't really know exactly what's going on and what this is telling us, but I think it might be interesting. And that seems like a good place to finish the course.